The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Before we start today's podcast, I want to tell you about a new exciting program called Rewire You. It's Second City's take on professional development, using the skills of improvisation to navigate an ever-complex and challenging business world with greater authenticity and resilience. More importantly, we have partnered with the Chicago Booth School at the University of Chicago to infuse the program with cutting-edge research from the world of behavioral science. Rewire You is great for current and future leaders who want to get more from themselves and their teams. You can find out more at secondcity.com/rewireu. Classes begin soon. Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Professor Katie Watson. Katie is an award-winning teacher of bioethics, law, and medical humanities at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She graduated from New York University's School of Law, clerked in the federal judiciary, and practiced public interest law before completing fellowships in clinical medical ethics at the University of Chicago Medical School's McLean Center and in medical humanities at Northwestern. Professor Watson also has a background in improvisation and theatrical writing. She's been improvising since 1997. She's the author of several sketch shows and plays. She's been an adjunct faculty member at the Second City Training Center since 2008. 15 years ago, she combined her knowledge of medicine and improv to create an innovative communication training method she calls medical improv. In January of 2017, Watson reduced her time at Northwestern to 2 days a week so she could take on a new role at the ACLU of Illinois as senior counsel for the Women's and Reproductive Rights Project. Katie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kelly. It's so nice to be here.
I've known you for a long while. That's a really impressive bio.
Oh, thanks.
You hide that from the improv community because I think it would intimidate them.
Well, it's just not relevant.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out.
Well,
we will find out about that.
You tell me.
So I would expect that most people's knee-jerk reaction to the thought that their doctor might be improvising is terrifying. But in fact, their ability to improvise could be the thing that could save a life.
Yeah,
right?
I think so. The knee-jerk reaction that's terrifying, I think, is a mistaken reflex. So there's this false belief that medicine is a cookbook, that your doctor's just memorized a lot of rules and facts and can, you know, is like a human computer that filters all this information and then spews out the quote right answer. And sure, it's terrifying in the existential sense that we would all like to think medicine is perfect and people are robots. But once you say the sentence, you know that's not true,
yeah.
Right? So there's, first of all, the creativity that is required in diagnostics. There's the creativity in resource limitation. There's the creativity in teamwork. And that creativity is a positive. When we say creativity means find the solution no one's seen before, suddenly you say, I do want a creative doctor. And improvisation simply means we're operating without a script. And I think people are, myself included, understandably frustrated when we're speaking with someone who purports to be a human being and yet speaks as if they are a scripted robot. So we both want the robot, but we don't want the robot, right?
Yeah.
And so what I found was my medical students, who were just incredibly brilliant, wonderfully warm, lovely, idealistic people who you'd have a terrific conversation with in the hallway, they put on that short white coat that students wear, and they would do a simulated encounter, and they would like act like a robot as they took on this new role. And you realize that like they were improvising, as we all are in every conversation when we arrive at the dinner table without a script in hand. But that when they went into the medical role, they actually were scripted. And they're taught scripted communication methods that we all can smell are false.
Right. And when you when you're improvising, it's as if someone only played high status characters.
Yeah.
It would drive you crazy.
They've got their one bit.
Yep.
And they just repeat it every night. It would get stale.
Right.
And you know, for actors who are doing scripted material, part of the challenge is, like, in this moment of the scene, you're surprised. Convince the audience, because you really knew it was going to happen.
Yeah.
And you know it every night. How do you have that freshness? Professional actors struggle with how to keep, you know, the King and I fresh.
Yeah.
The idea that a physician saying the scripted words is going to deliver it as if it's the first time they've said it is a lot to ask.
There's really not a ton of academic research on improvisation.
Yeah.
But there is some. And we're doing work with the Center for Decision Research at Booth to do more of this research.
Mm-hmm.
But I found a paper on crisis and improvisation by a couple of French scholars who names – I can't pronounce their names, so I'm not even going to try. Specifically, they're looking to, quote, explain how improvisation concretely happens during crisis response and transforms into collective improvisation.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I found sort of fascinating.
Love
so it. Is that what you found at the sort of group improv?
Well, yes and no. So I think what I haven't read that article, but
yep.
from what you said, I would translate that into improv speak into the concept of group mind. And so when my former program chair started showing up at Sirens shows, the group I'm in, and I found that terrifying. But what she was so interested in is, how do you all do that? It looks like you have a script, and I don't believe that you don't at least agree on a plot or this or that in long form. And having to explain to her what group mind is and how you make that look seamless, I think similarly in an emergency room where the bus comes in and there's a lot of, you know, that of course there are formulas and routines and practice skill sets, but that, like, there's something that happens collectively. And so playing on what the French authors of this article are saying, I think in crisis, the point is you don't have a template, but you do have a filter. Mm-hmm. And I think we're not always good about separating out the difference between templates and filters.
Hmm.
And I just made that up when
no,
I said
I like
this
it,
sentence. So let's remember it. Let's go with it. So a template is my memorized outline of, you know, and those are great in medicine. Like, someone comes in and they're not breathing. I really hope you have a template for how to, like, get an airway. This is good, because pretty consistent here, you know, here's what you're going to do. But in a crisis situation, there is no template, but you still have the filters, and the filters are your expertise, your content expertise. And the filters are the human qualities that you bring and that you have that are unique to you.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the Apollo 13. We've got a tube sock and a cardboard box, and failure's not an option. And so I think the idea that crisis draws on your improvisational skills. So we could make a whole list of improvisational skills. The first one is don't freeze.
Yeah.
The second one is move collectively. Don't just, you're not out there by yourself. You've got a group. So third, group mind. Look up. What's happening? Who else is doing what? Where could you be useful? Number four, you don't know what's going to happen, but you know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
I swear you know the answer. You just don't. It hasn't moved from your body or your brain to your mouth yet.
Yep.
Move anyway. And so I think that that's interesting in crisis response, but I hope not every day is a crisis. I hope not every medical encounter fits that model. But what I love about improvisation is, if you and I are doing a scene, I'm looking at you right now, and I could make some assessments, and some people would call them judgments, but if they were value neutral, I just call them assessments about your age, your gender, your demeanor, your dress. But in improvisation, if you walk in, I don't know if you're playing a 90-year-old African-American woman.
Right.
And I will say out loud, you are white in the real life,
or
you're playing a 5-year-old boy. And so I have to throw away the surface visual and go with, I have to look very deeply, right? And so in the physician-patient relationship, or nurse-patient, or physician's assistant-patient, or fill in the blank, the idea is that to be aware of the judgments or shortcuts we're taking and really listen to that person. And so while it's not a crisis, the idea is that, like, be ready for the surprise. So in improv, when we say the first unusual thing, follow. And in medicine, if you've got a template, the template blocks out the unusual thing.
Hmm.
It says that's the red herring. You know, I got to go through this, you know, diabetes assessment. But if the unusual thing happens, improv teaches you to say, huh, tell me more about that. The trick is, medical appointments are short, and I don't want to frame them as a crisis, but the improvisational spirit is like, I am open to what's actually happening in the room?
I love my doctor. Mm-hmm. Her name's Dr. Lois Miller.
And shout out to Dr. Miller.
Total shout out. But this is what I love about Lois, which is the first 15 minutes is a conversation.
You have great insurance.
Yeah, right.
Many people are out the door within 15.
Yeah, no, we and I've been going to her for years. Mm-hmm. And she starts with, like, talk to me. And it's anything. In fact, and I talked to her about this. I was like, hey, you'd be interested in the my conversation with Katie that's coming up. And she was fascinated by it.
Great.
Totally believed it. Like, but then she sort of figures out where I'm at. She's like, okay, you were kind of stressed last time you were here. You seem less stressed. That's a good thing.
So she's diagnosing you because you could be talking about gardening or the weather or spaghetti making as your new hobby. Mm-hmm. But what she's hearing is different than the content.
Right. Which is also the thing in improvisation. It would not be funny if the thing we're talking about is the thing we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's always what's underneath that,
right,
and what's behind that and what discoveries are going to make.
Right. So what's happening in the room now? Yes, at the surface we're talking about spaghetti, but what's really going on is, you know, we haven't seen each other in a long time and we're making sure we're still friends. Or, you know what I mean? It doesn't have to be the funny thing, but it's just the, like, there's obviously often so many trains running in communication. And a lot of it is just like, I get you. I like you. I'm here for you.
And 'cause getting to truth ain't easy.
Right.
For any of us. And if you do have a problem, I know this for myself, and I think it's true for others, is that if I do have an issue I'm worried about, I'm not blurting it out when I walk in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for my time to sort of share that. And I want to add, when you were talking earlier about what happens when you go into this crisis mode, Carl Weick, who's at the University of Michigan, talks about sense making and these three things: detection, mobilization, and response. So those, and he says, quote, those three mechanisms enabled collective improvisation to be coherent. Detection, mobilization, and response.
Mm-hmm.
So a kind of a very similar category, a suite that you were going for as well.
Mm-hmm.
So and this is a scholar who isn't necessarily talking about improvisation in the way or an understanding of the way that you and I have it from our years inside it. But it's interesting too, because Weick's work's been around for a while. What I'm finding in the university system, having done the work with Booth, and I'm curious what your experiences have, is it really wasn't for me until the last couple of years that people were willing to have these conversations seriously.
Mm-hmm.
In a wide way. You've been at this for a while, so people have been taking you more seriously than me, which makes sense. I'm going to say right there.
I'm not sure that's true.
Did you have skepticism when you first started this?
The skepticism came from me.
Okay.
This person I mentioned is named Catherine Montgomery. And so when I was a fellow doing my medical humanities fellowship, and then afterwards, there's this opportunity, there's this course, a 10-hour course that people develop new ideas and teach. And as we talked about it, I was saying, I think this would be so helpful for medical students, but they'll never buy it. And she, having no background in improvisation, is the epitome of yes and the freedom to fail. She was just brilliant, and she is all about, that sounds interesting, let's find out. And I just, that's my attitude too. Like, I always say to my students when they say, like, I'm thinking of project X, which is a sure thing, and project Y, which could fail, I'm always like, let's do Y, because let's find out. Like, X is not interesting. You already know it will succeed. Save that for when you need something. So she was very much like, let's try it. And I thought that the students would think, you know, here comes Auntie Mame, and I took this because I thought it would be a blow off and whatever.
Right.
And the first time I did it, it just got rave reviews, and they were, you know, making all these connections that were just very preliminary for me. And I thought, well, that's an aberration, you know, that's, and I did it again. I thought, well, here's the group that will find out that this is not worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And it took, you know, some people, I swear to God, in academia, some people sneeze and write a case report about their own sneeze. And it just makes me insane, the trees that are killed for this drivel, for CV padding. You know,
right,
whenever someone tells you they have, I don't know what the magic number is, and, you know, then I don't know what the right number is, but if someone tells you they have, in X years of teaching, they have 50 publications, you should be very impressed. I don't know what the right number is. 100. If they tell you they have 300 publications, you should say there's something.
Right.
You either wrote about things that weren't important, or you put your name on things that you really shouldn't have, because there's not enough hours in the day, right?
No.
And so for me, it took me, I gathered 8 years of data before I was like, I guess this is invaluable. I guess it's reliable. And these were small groups. And I published that in 2011. To say, like, students really love this and think it really matters and is important. So I didn't get, criticism or skepticism. It came from myself, which is something to be said there, too. I think sometimes that's called humility, and it's not a bad thing.
Well, a little bit of humility, a little bit of imposter syndrome.
Could be, yeah, because doing improv in a medical school, like, right. I'm there to be a bioethicist, and this other thing, and I thought those things were separate, and it took someone who just is a very creative boss to be like, no, we want all of you.
Well, and this is great leadership, right?
Exactly. Other people say, here's the job description. To the degree you fit the box, you fail or succeed. She was the kind of person who said, of course, here's what we do. If you're a veterinarian, I probably can't use you, but... you do something core we do, but also then how can I utilize everything you have to offer? Because I want to get everything out of you and I want you to surprise me and bring something I've never thought of. That is great leadership. And I really, that model has stuck with me and it's so consistent with improv.
Yeah. Well, and you know, at Second City, we get all these calls for various business schools
sure.
who want to bring us in to help the students be more collaborative and communicative. And you wrote that, quote, successful medical training requires student communication skills that are rarely taught but often required.
Mm-hmm.
They're not taught, right?
Right.
Bedside manner, not taught?
Well, we try.
Yeah.
We try, sure.
Well, I know you try. I mean,
we do try, but like I even meant by that, like, successful, even to be success as a student. So, like, I get students who are sent to me because their mentor said, you haven't spoken all year and you're going to get crucified when you hit the wards and people are pimping you for answers. You know, you have to be able to speak up. So I think of that, even those student skills. How can I learn? I have to speak and say what I know and be willing to be wrong so I can be corrected.
Yep.
So there's that. We sure try to teach bedside manner and such. It's hard to teach. And
yep.
I think that the medical model, I don't want to overstate it, but there's so much information, there's so much science, there's so much curricular time. Again, I think we have these, our job in a way is, well, we have two jobs. One, we have 1,000 jobs, but let me mention
yeah.
two of them. One is to take these lovely young people and to not beat it out of them.
Right.
So that by the end of the training, they're a very well-informed hollow shell of a person who has that terrible bedside manner because, like, we've just beaten this lovely empathy and communication out of them. And the second is, it's one thing to say they came in good communicators. You try to tell me that I'm dying.
Mm-hmm.
You try to tell me that something's really wrong with my child. You try to tell me that I have this whole host of symptoms and you don't know what it is and mm-hmm. you're not going to be able to figure it out for a long time, maybe ever. You try to have that conversation with me and we all think we're good communicators.
Yep.
Those are very hard conversations. And now try to have that conversation with, like, fill in the blank, 50 different personality types and people with 50 different, a whole constellation of things going on in their lives and where they're at. So even if you did it really well with that one person, the exact same approach is going to tank with person number 10.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the communication challenges that I think we are not always respectful. Also, do it in 15 minutes.
Right.
Also, you haven't met and they've been burned by 30 other doctors or whatever, the whole team who thought someone else was going to tell them. And now it's way too late and you're the one who's going to walk in and be like, oh, no one told you this, but hello, my name's Katie.
Right.
You know, like, that's hard.
Well, and we're talking about medical professionals. We could be talking about lawyers.
Sure.
We could be talking about CEOs.
Yeah.
We could be about human resources. I mean, in general, and we you know, and I love...
Yes and no, Kelly. I hate to interrupt you, and I
Do
think
it.
They're overlapping skill sets, but the intimacy of medicine is different. I'm never going to take my underwear off for any of those people.
I hope you aren't.
Stop. Hard stop. Period. I will not be naked in front of any of those people, and they don't get to touch me.
Right.
And I will not tell them my secrets.
Yeah.
And so the intimacy of medicine is different, and the expectation, literally my life will be on the line potentially, or my healthy baby, or my just day-to-day well-being, because these allergies are killing me every day, and I'm just not delivering at work because I'm always sneezing. Whatever the thing is, the stakes, the immediacy, the visceral element and the intimacy is qualitatively different. And though I think it is, they overlap and they have commonalities, you know, each profession has its specificity too.
Right.
And so I interrupted you, please go on. Because
I think that you're exactly right. Because the the level of intimacy correlates to something that is sort of primal and human
the
in a way.
Vulnerability.
Oh, yeah, huge. And so this sort of, and I want to dig into a few of these areas because this nicely transitions into this idea around empathy.
Yeah.
All right, and we talk about this a lot in improvisation. Mm-hmm. I found a quote by Daniel Goleman, who I love. He says, quote, "When we focus on others, our world expands." And in improvisation, we talk about the need to be others focused. There's a lot of attention put on that. Mm-hmm. What do you pull out of improvisation to bring into your training that you do with the medical students as it relates to empathy?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do some work around this. There are multiple things that are hard about empathy in medicine. One is, what is one person's phenomenal crisis is something you see 30 times a day. Mm-hmm. And so that's like a different level of empathy. I mean, that like you can be other focused, but sort of like I've been here before a lot and I have a different view of that. So I think that there's an interesting challenge in improvisation, improvisational techniques of saying it's got to be like the first time and in a certain way. On the other hand, if every time you deliver a cancer diagnosis or you deliver a baby, which is you know is and you hope and you think is going to be healthy, but labor's scary and hard, if you experience it at the same level someone else is experiencing it, you would never get out of bed the next morning, right? You can't do that. And so in the medical profession, empathy is just a fascinating and different kind of and beast, I want to say, and then I hesitated because I don't want to call it a beast. But so how do you retain your own integrity and say, I'm not the one with cancer. I'm not the one in labor. You know, like I gotta hold tight here. Mm-hmm. Number two is I got to keep my focus on the medicine, too. Like I can't get so wrapped up in the emotion and the empathy that I lose track of the oncology or the obstetrics. Right. Number three, we are two people in a room sharing a very intimate experience, and I have to have empathy for your emotional response in that. Again, like
that's a
lot of levels of empathy.
And it is almost like a, you know, we're sitting here in a studio and there's all these levels, right?
Right.
That you have to move up and down.
So in improv, using improv, but to say like, okay, you've done this a lot. What I find in clinicians, and I work with experienced clinicians too, or like people in residency or fellowship or then later practice, sometimes what they have knowingly or unknowingly, or perhaps they always did this and no one ever told them the difference, they substituted for empathy was fixing.
Huh.
Because that's what they're trying to do is to fix.
Sure,
and you came to be fixed. Mm-hmm. So you're very upset. I can fix that. Or you're very upset. That's not fixable. So let's move on. Or you're very upset and I'm fixing something else. And so you're going to be happy once it's fixed. Or, you know, the fixing thing. Mm-hmm. And so to had to kind of step away from that. But the emotional bandwidth for, you know, such a trendy word. But like, I just think sometimes we underestimate what we ask. We want physicians to like kind of be our best friend, therapist, you know, coffee clatch, except I would also like you to be a technical expert. And why does this cost so much?
Right. Are you familiar with Paul Bloom and his like stuff against empathy?
A little bit. Say
yeah,
more.
He acknowledges that that's like coming out against kittens.
Yeah.
And I think what he talks about there. We did a podcast with Kim Scott, who talks about ruinous empathy, which I completely understand. That this is the kind of the empathy that allows you to not speak truth to someone who needs truth.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're talking about. Like mm-hmm. so. And I think when you come out against empathy, obviously, I think that sells books. Uh-huh. And I think it maybe cuts through noise and clutter. And that's why you do that.
Yeah.
But I think it's false.
Not
it's
really
false.
What you mean.
It's not really what you
you're,
mean.
You're against crappy empathy or false empathy or unnecessary empathy or unhelpful empathy, blah, 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 blah. But that's like a really long book title.
Yeah, exactly. And you're not going to sell a lot of books. So I get it. All right. I want to talk about storytelling.
Okay.
Almost every company in America has realized its need to embrace an element of storytelling, mm-hmm. not just to like sell its products to consumers, but to have its own staff understand why they are working and who they work for and why they should be working on different things.
Mm-hmm.
How do you use storytelling in the medical improv context?
Uh-huh. Well, so storytelling is central to medicine, right? Mm-hmm. And there's this whole completely freestanding thing that has nothing to do with me, this amazing field called narrative medicine, which usually uses the insights and content of literature and narrative theory and approaches to say, you know, what is that chart? It's a story, a chart. Who's the narrator of that story? Who's the protagonist? What's the, you know? And so there's this whole other field that thinks about storytelling very carefully in medicine. What I do about storytelling is I'm very interested in collaborative storytelling and shared storytelling, because medicine is now a team sport. Mm-hmm. And so how is it that you can have a multi-narrator story? So when you think about conducted story or all these different kinds of improv exercises we do, being able to tell your part of the story and also hear someone else's contribution to the story, it's really hard. I mean, you know, we know how hard it is.
Yeah.
So we do exercises and think about that every patient-physician interaction is about a co-created story. And physicians commonly want to impose that template, that story, like, oh, you're coughing this is the medical story, or this is who you are, this is whatever, because it gets them out of the room faster and it's comforting. It's things we take for granted, as you know, then feel revelatory in other contexts. The idea that if each sentence in an improv scene is a brick and you and I are building something together, and if we don't come in with a blueprint, we don't know, you know, what structure we're going to build. If you can think of a patient interaction like that, and we're going to build this together, that will be a much more satisfying interaction for both of you to say, we have together created the story of here's what's going on with you physically, here's how it fits in your life, here's how I can be helpful, here's how I can't be helpful in what you need to do next in other ways. Like, there's that version of the story. And then there's the interdisciplinary team story where we say, what does it mean to have the chaplain's point of view, the social worker's point of view, the physical therapist's point of view, the pharmacist's point of view, the physician's point of view? And then is the patient a member of that storytelling team or not? And to have some honest conversations about that. What about the family member? What about the, you know, if we don't squelch those voices, we have a much messier story, but we
but it's a Rashomon.
Richer.
It's a much richer story.
We have a richer story. And so I refer to that as linear storytelling versus mosaic storytelling. So my term for that is mosaic, because if you look too close at a mosaic or you see someone starting a mosaic, it just looks like a bunch of little, like, pretty pieces of glass that don't make any sense. And then you have to step back and say, oh my gosh, that's a mermaid, you know? And so the idea is, like, can you just be cool with the ambiguity of each voice, each sentence, and say, I trust something, that mermaid's going to come out, or we're going to get it, and we'll be like, oh, let's put some glass here and here and here, and then that'll make that comprehensible.
We talked to Tina Seelig, who's a professor in the engineering department at Stanford, and she talks about the difference in problem solving between people who are solving puzzles and people who create quilts. And the problem with the puzzle is if you're missing a piece, it's never going to finish. But when you're making a quilt, that's that sort of collective storytelling. I found this great quote by Kipling, who wrote, if history were taught in the form of stories, it will never be forgotten.
Yeah.
And I think that first thing you mentioned in terms of recognizing how people respond to storytelling in terms of really understanding what's going on. And then secondly, this deeper thing, which is in improvisation, because we have a tricky relationship with story,
right?
In when you improvise, because you can't get into too much storytelling, because then you're driving the scene. It's that status thing we were talking about. And there's unreliable narrators, which can be okay. Mm-hmm. And the best improvisation, that's kind of, you want some of that. Mm-hmm. But it does require you to flex a muscle we don't flex all that often. And that's the thing I keep finding as we take improvisation into all these different areas, where it goes, is that you realize for humans in general, they are not oriented well in giving up part of their story.
Yeah.
Or sometimes they won't tell a story. And they just allow other people to tell their story. Mm-hmm. So I find this really interesting. Okay, we're running. Go ahead.
The sentence I want to say is,
please,
here's the difference between a real story and an improvised story. Mm-hmm. And so when it really is my story, and I'm the sick one, or I'm the doctor, and I really want to interrupt you to say, this is going to be okay, stop talking.
Yep.
Those are real stories that are competing for airspace. When it's improv, we're hesitant to give them up. And those are made up. They don't exist.
Yeah.
And so for real people, telling real facts, it's even more challenging.
Totally. All right, we're running out of time, but and I'm going to ask you in a second. I'm going to close by asking you for a yes and story, a moment from your life where you normally would have said no, but you said yes and to it. All right. So about that. But I want to ask you for lastly about feedback. So we've been talking a lot about this with our friends at the University of Chicago, and this idea that a lot of the research around feedback is that much of it does not work, mm-hmm. Especially in a corporate setting.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I found really interesting was that the research that does exist in feedback is that novices, when you're working with novices, they require encouragement. Almost exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that if you have a two-year-old playing with a toy, you're not going to say you're not playing with that toy right. You're going to be like, great work.
Yeah.
And when we were talking about this with the scholars, it made us think of side coaching.
Uh-huh.
And so we actually did side coaching in the room for them. And they were like, that's interesting.
Yeah.
How that could maybe be applied.
Supportive. It's encouragement.
It is. And it's these little, and for folks who don't know that, when you're side coaching in improv and two people are doing a scene, the coach might say something like, you have names.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are someplace.
Mm-hmm.
You have an activity. Just little nudges to get them going for someone who's new. Do you deal with feedback inside your medical improv? Yeah.
Yeah. So some of it's surreptitious in the sense that I'm doing side coaching and then we point out at the end of like, let's talk about feedback. None of you fell apart when I did that and because you knew I was doing it to help you. When you're being critiqued by your clinical mentors instead of taking it as a negative, some of it's how you interpret. It's not even how the feedback's given. It's how you receive it. And if you say, this person's on my team and they're saying this so I can be better when they're not there, I'm a feedback whore. I mean, it's just the idea of like, those of us who are like, tell me what I'm doing wrong. Help me. Like, because it's such a gift.
Yeah.
But when you're just treading water and you think you're about to drown and someone's like, also, you could do this. It's like, oh my God, stay away. And so figuring out like, and then in improv, we learn when to take a note and when to move on. And both times you nod and smile. And you nod and smile and say thank you to the one you think that is going to change everything I do. That was a gift. And you nod and smile at the one where you say, I am so overwhelmed, it doesn't even matter if that's useful. I can't.
Thank you for the note.
You just nod and smile and say thank you. It's up to you.
Yep. All right. I wish we had more time, but I do want to ask you if you have a yes and story.
Well, I probably have 1,000 of them, but because that has really changed because like many people, I know someone who said people go into things that they're bad at to get better at them. It's so interesting to look at people's fields and why they chose them. So for me, improv was all about like I was bad at sports. So to learn how to be a team player and all these different things. So I really internalized a lot of things. I'm very conscious of it. But I remember, so I was a lawyer at the Legal Assistance Foundation in Chicago. And that's when I first started doing improv. And then I went to University of Chicago to have an informational interview with their clinical ethics program because ethics is something I'd done in law school. And I was just thinking maybe that's something in the future I would want to explore. But I had no intention of quitting my job to do this fellowship. So I went to talk to the physician who runs that program just on information. I'd sent him my resume and said, could you talk? And at the end of a spirited conversation, he said, well, would you like to be a fellow next year? And like you usually have to file a giant application and it's a long process and they took 8 people and only one would be a non-physician each year. And I was not intending to quit my job or do that yet. But it was one of those things to think like, well, who knows if next year I would get that one spot. And I remember very clearly thinking the rules of improvisation require me to say yes and.
Yeah.
To this opportunity that I didn't want and didn't ask for and doesn't make a whit of sense in one way. But in another way, there's a reason I made this meeting and we're sitting in this chair. I'm the one who set this up and that door just opened. So there's 100 more like that. But that idea, but I remember that was the first time because I was newer to improv, to being like, everything in me says, not yet. It's not how I planned it. It's not, but I, and just to be, wow, I'm surprised.
And you didn't have to sacrifice any of your passions. Your passions just added on top of each other.
Yeah, like it was a juggle and I had to leave my job and then I worked at a law firm part-time to support my academic habit because fellowships don't charge, but they don't pay. And I kept doing improv and whatever, but it's just, when I was young, I was all about the 5-year plan and talk about the difference between templates and filters. Your filter tells you this feels right. Your template tells you this was not this is not on the schedule. And I think you should go with the filter.
Katie Watson, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks.